Welcome to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. Thanks for joining us tonight. It's Brickyard Week coming up on Sunday afternoon at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Activity Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, jam-packed with action with the Sprint Cup Series and Xfinity Series. I think there's something like 8 hours of practice on Friday, the Xfinity race around 4 o'clock on Saturday afternoon, along with Cup qualifying, and then the Cup race, the Crown Royal 400. I haven't gotten the verbiage down yet of what it is. It's too many characters, but it's your name here.
Well, they've got a name now.
We've got a name, yeah. And I've got a, as I said, I depend
Jeff,
on
Jeff
some...
Jeff Kyle,
Jeff
I
Kyle,
believe.
Thank
yeah.
you. I depend on someone like Kurt to write a nice story to tell this hero, this true hero's yeah. story, because that is something that I really do like, even though we joke about the length of the name. I do like that someone who has either served their country or done something else above and beyond the call of your typical duty as a citizen gets a chance to have some time on the spotlight. So that's the good part of that. And we'll get to see some racing at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway this weekend. And we get an opportunity to visit with Donald, for you to ask Donald questions. It can be concerning NASCAR at IMS, NASCAR drivers in the 500, IndyCar drivers doing NASCAR, or just anything you like that you didn't get to get in the month of May. Now, before we continue, because I know last night you mentioned, you'd be surprised that I remembered this, because I don't remember much, you wanted to finish talking about Tony Bettenhausen Jr.
Oh, I did.
Did you forget that?
Yes, I did, because I was...
Good on me. I don't remember much.
Well, you go home, and you think about all the things, the sentences that you didn't finish, and the thoughts that you had in mind that you never got to. Very quickly, there was another driver who apparently sang at least a little, and that was Floyd Roberts. It was rather a surprise to me, and I read an account. This is the 1938 winner. In 1936, there was rather an unusual situation where he was involved in an accident with Doc McKenzie at a dirt track race in the East. And they were both quite seriously injured, and they were in the same hospital room. They, you know, share with beds in side by side in the same room. And Doc McKenzie was engaged to be married, and they went ahead and did the ceremony with him in the bed, and Floyd Roberts was the best man in the other bed, and apparently he sang a song called I Love You Truly. And I don't know what the rendition was like, but the very fact that he would take that on, and when you see the photographs of Floyd Roberts, he does not look like somebody that would... That would sing. But and when I mentioned it to both the son and daughter, who are both living, they were so small when he lost his life that they did not remember that. But I don't think that it really surprised any of them. But Tony Bettenhausen, yeah, what I was going to talk about a little bit was that his mother, after his father was lost his life in 1961, his mother, Valerie, remarried, and a gentleman by the name of Webb Stephen, and they moved to Houston, Texas. And so Tony finished out school there, and in fact, he took auto mechanics, and a driver by the name of Bill Holmeyer, who once babysat Foyt, was his shop teacher. Well, anyway, Gordon Van Loo, Vita Fresh Orange Juice, lived in Houston, One Shatter Way. And why I remember that dress, I have no idea, but that one's carved in granite forever. And I actually went to that house. Anyway, because Gordon Van Loo was out of racing now, but he knew that Tony and respected the father, he actually sponsored him in Late Model Sportsman. And in those days, it's now what they call the Xfinity Series, except it's changed greatly. And in those days, I don't know how many hundred races that they would have in a year's time, and they would have like state championships. And so possibly they could have, you know, 7 or 8 point paying races in the same night, and you would have to decide which one you were going to go to. Some drivers didn't travel. They only ran their local track. And then you had the ones that were going for points, and it meant that you had to run a lot. And you didn't necessarily have to win all the time, but if you kept going to the races and finishing 8th and 10th and so on and so forth, you could really build up the points. And in whatever year this was, I'm embarrassed to say that I don't recall, but it probably would have been around 76 or 7. Tony Battenhausen Jr., as a young kid, was second in late model sportsman to a guy named Jack Ingram. And then he went up to what we now call Sprint Cup, except back then I think it was still Winston or Grand National or something.
Yeah, before the 70s, it wasn't Winston. It was Grand National Series?
Absolutely, yeah. So up until 71. Well, by that time, then it would have been Winston was on board. But anyway, he ran, a couple of seasons, and including he ran in the Daytona 500. And I was down there in, what year would this be, 76 or so, what I said about the years would be a little bit earlier, because he left NASCAR and went up and started running USAC, and I think that was probably about 74, 75. So anyway, in 76, I was down for the Daytona 500, and he was back down there as a guest. I mean, he just had a pit pass and was, but anyway, the point was that it was really the people that he knew was very, I mean, he was sort of just, yelling abuse and getting abuse from all kinds of people. And NASCAR being very different in those days. I mean, you had Richard Petty and you had David Pearson and Cale Yarborough. And then you had a lot of guys that were from the South that had been running forever that as I've explained a few times just recently, sponsorship wasn't big. And a lot of those guys, they would wear engineer boots and they would smoke cigarettes and have sideburns. And they would have a sort of like a wrinkled fire retardant treated uniform, but it would just have their name stitched and maybe one or two patches. And I remember Grant Adcox was a driver who was from Tennessee or something, and like a lot of those Southern guys, really funny. And it was so neat to just hang out with Tony for a little bit and his interaction with all of these people. And then a final note before we move on here. When you were throwing, we were throwing out the names of drivers who sang, Marty Robbins went through my mind, and I didn't do that one because he was a singer who drove.
Mm-hmm.
But a quick story, Larry Rice, the late Larry Rice, a great guy, really miss him. And he was extremely popular, USAC midget champion and a sprint Silver Crown guy, and drove in the 500 Rookie of the Year. Anyway, he lived, I think it was on Exeter or something. It was one of the north-south streets about 5-6 blocks east of the underpass. Just one of those little houses in not quite Eagledale. And Robin lived with him for a while. And it was one of those places where there was always like 5 or 6 people living at this place, some Aussies and New Zealanders and a lot of visitors. Anyway, he used to have a party every May. And it got bigger and bigger and bigger. There would be some 500 people, but there was a lot of sprint car and midgets and Aussies and New Zealand visitors. And I mean, it got to the point where they would have like 200 or 300 people at this little house, and the neighbors would complain. So this, and the traffic would be parked. I mean, if you got there late, as I went to the thing a few times, you'd have to sort of park blocks away and walk back to the thing. So anyway, this one year, and I think it might have been 76, and there were complaints from the neighbors, and so the cops arrived and knocked on the door and said, look, could you hold the noise down because the neighbors are complaining. And then one of them said, well, the fellow at the backyard is singing, boy, he's really good. And so Rice said, oh, that's Marty Robbins. And Marty Robbins had just shown up with his guitar, and he's just basically playing because he was an enthusiast. And so they said, wow, you're kidding, Marty Robbins? And Rice said, yeah, he's a great guy. You want to meet him? Come on back. So they go back, and then there's all the different drivers that they're talking with, and pretty soon a second lot of cops arrive to find out what happened to the first lot. So they would just say to Rice, like, if you could just kind of hold it down, could you tell your 200 guests to please hold it down just a little bit? But anyway, it's my Marty Robbins story. And he did drive, I don't remember how many what I still call Grand National races, and he ran in the Daytona 500 several times.
Yeah, he did quite a few races
in
the early 70s.
I think he had a fourth at Michigan, I believe. I haven't looked that up for a while, but that's stuck in my mind that, at MIS, in when things were a little politically different, they had the Yankee 400. I don't think we're going to be doing that one anymore. But anyway, I think Marty Robbins was fourth in that race.
Very good story. Very good. All right, to your questions now for Donald at 317-239-1070. And we start with Debbie in Indianapolis.
Hi, Debbie.
Oh, good evening.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, Donald, I had a question about the safety team out at the Speedway, if you could talk a little bit about them. And why do they have the name Homatro, and what is Homatro?
Oh, golly. Homatro
is a corporate sponsorship.
Thank you. I'm glad you were here tonight.
I should know this, but I think they make tools. I'll Google that. As you can tell, I'm not very handy. But that is just simply a corporate sponsorship.
I would
because they were called Delphi at one time. That was the corporate sponsorship at that time.
I really wouldn't be doing a fair service to address this. I'll just say that the standard at the Indianapolis Speedway is just outstanding, and when they go on the road, and in fact, even, and I'm a little hazy on the incident, even although I think it was at Newton, where there was an incident where somebody got in the wall, and before you could blink, here comes the safety truck.
Well, it's that way every week.
Yeah, I know.
The cars incredible. Are sometimes they're still rolling.
Yeah.
And that's the advantage that IndyCar, frankly, has over NASCAR. NASCAR, it's not the same people every week. I'm sure that NASCAR has someone or two people that are heading up safety that travel, but it's local guys. And you know, the race I was watching, I think it was the Cup race this past weekend, car caught on fire, the fire truck stops, and the first thing happens is a fireman gets out, takes two steps, and he falls over. You know, and it's not funny. Because the Homatro guys are the best in the business. Homatro is a dedicated to providing innovative, Homatro hydraulic equipment and systems are used for rescue, so this is a nice tie-in, industrial and special tactics operations around the world. They demand reliable tools under all circumstances to make sure that Homatro users can fulfill their specialized tasks. So it would sound to me like fire departments and others would use Homatro, so it is a fantastic tie-in.
Well, as far as the safety at the Speedway, and I don't really know what would be the reason for this, but I would say that it was in like the late 50s is when the response time really picked up. Not that it was ever slow. I mean, I think it was always outstanding at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. But just as the pit stops lessened in time, picked up in speed and, and lessened in time, not pioneered by the Wood Brothers, by the way, and we might want to address that one again about how that the Wood Brothers supposedly won the 65 Indianapolis 500 for Clark. But just as the pit stops picked up in the late 50s, early 60s, so did the response time. And if you watch the standard 25-minute documentaries about the 500, you know, the Firestone films, Champion films, whatever you want to call them, whenever especially in practice, the number of times where you see where there's an accident takes place, and it's still happening, and here they come. And I think by, you know, 61, 62, it had really picked up. So when the Europeans came here, just very shortly after that, they were very impressed because they were used to an accident happening at the Nürburgring or Spa, and it took 15, 20 minutes to get emergency vehicles there. Here, I mean, their jaws dropped when they saw the response time. Mm-hmm. Absolutely phenomenal. So hats off to them for what, you know, what it's been like. It's been that way for 50-something years.
And then what started at IMS continued. CART went to the next level. People like Steve Olvey and Terry Trammell and others developed the full-time safety team that traveled with CART. And then when the Indy Racing League was formed in 96, they had the same standards. And then eventually many of the same medical people and safety people that were working on CART and Champ Car came over and formed this one group. But both CART and the Indy Racing League have been top-notch.
It just continues on. And as I say, just in, I think it was the last race, within the last few days, and I even mentioned, I commented to my wife, I said, look at that, just response time. I mean, that accident hasn't even finished yet, and they're already there.
All right, more questions for Donald. Thank you, Debbie. Good question. 317-239-1070. It's the Talk of Gasoline Alley on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. It's the Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson, the special summertime edition ahead of this weekend's activities at the world's greatest race course, NASCAR, here with the Brickyard 400. 239-1070 is our number. Full phone lines. When someone hangs up, that is your cue to call in. Jeff in Joliet, Illinois, is next with Donald. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Jeff.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, Kevin. First, I'd like to say thanks for all you do to promote the sport. You do it in a positive way, which doesn't happen a whole lot out there.
Thank you.
Donald, my question for you. I know Rick Mears was a spotter, or still is a spotter, for Penske, and Poncho Carter was Sam Hornish's spotter. I was just wondering what former drivers are spotters at Indianapolis.
I think Kevin would be better at that one. I think, does Buddy Rice spot for somebody?
He just started again recently. He's done it before, but he started spotting for Ed Carpenter a couple of weeks ago. And I saw Buddy at Iowa and saw him at Milwaukee, so he's one. As far as other
Is Poncho doing somebody at the moment?
Yeah, Poncho is with Tristan Vaudier on one of the Dale Coyne cars, and one of his sons, Cole, is a spotter. He might, I shouldn't say that because I'm just kind of guessing who I thought he was. There are a few guys that have been Indy Lights drivers, but I'm trying to think of another Oh, you know who I saw this weekend that I hadn't seen for a little while? It was Roger Yasukawa. Was there with Takuma Sato, but he has not been his spotter all season.
No, in fact, I didn't see him in May at all. He sometimes sit up in the media center.
I can't recall if I saw him this year or not, but I see him most May. Some years he's doing media work. Some years he's there working as a spotter, but we see Roger now and again. That's all I'm thinking of now, but I'm probably, you know, a few years ago Tom Sneva did it. But it's been quite a few years. You know, that's, I bet that's been 7 or 8 or 9 years since I've seen Tom Sneva.
Oh, Jacques Lozier spotted for Robbie Gordon in 2004 and then ended up replacing him during a rain delay.
Yeah, and it's possible Jacques has done it since. I see him at the track on occasion. He worked on the radio broadcast at Fontana because he lives nearby. Maybe someone will tweet me.
I was
another
actually
one
watching,
who I'm forgetting because I'm guessing there's another one or two.
Off on a bit of a tangent here, but during a rain delay at a NASCAR race, and I don't remember what that was, they're all running together for me now, but Dale Jarrett, when they went to the booth and they had the three fellows standing there, Dale Jarrett, they were talking about spotters, and he said the best spotters are drivers, former drivers, or pilots.
Sure.
I thought that was pretty interesting.
You know, I've had a lot of conversations just recently. Oftentimes, I ride up the elevator with spotters that are going above the TV booth, and there's some of them are people that I've known for a long time that, yes, have been around racing, but that's always my question. How do you do this?
Yeah.
I understand how drivers do it because they understand what a driver is doing, but I would not want that responsibility at all.
No.
So much is at stake. So much is going on. I don't know how they do that and keep track of things, and it is overwhelming. You know,
totally
I'm sure that they have a headache at the end of the night at a place like Fontana or Iowa or Milwaukee, and it's even harder when your driver's not doing well, because then it's like a GT car and a sports car race.
You're keep digging, bud.
Well, no, you're trying to stay out of the way.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
it's all right. Inside in five.
When you
inside in three, clear. All right, here's another one coming. Five back. Three, you know, that kind of thing.
And then when you're listening to it probably on a replay as an accident's taking place, and then when you think, what's it like for the driver to hear, go low, go high, go high, go low, go low, go low, go high. What are you supposed to do?
And that's, that happens more in NASCAR. In IndyCar, the driver's just kind of on their own. There's just, and plus you just can't yank the thing left when you're going 180 miles an hour. You just kind of have to go for your spot and hope it's clear when you get there.
That's why my heroes of Jim Rathman and Roger Ward didn't have spotters. They were out there and they had to figure it out for themselves.
Jeff, thanks for the question.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And if somebody comes up with another former IndyCar driver and sends it to me at KevinLee23, we'll mention that before we're done tonight. Thank you. Paul and Racine is up next. Hello, Paul.
Hey, Paul.
Hi, Donald. Hi, Kevin. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay, fantastic. One thing before I ask my question is I wanted to kind of talk a little bit about what you talked about with the IndyCar drivers who qualified for the first Brickyard. There are two things about Foyt that I thought were rather interesting. I remember being there. Foyt, I believe, actually bumped Davy Jones, which was a former driver of his. I thought that was kind of interesting.
I think that was right, although Davy ended up missing it by about five spots. But technically, it was Foyt actually bumped him out of the field. Yeah.
And I just thought that was interesting because I believe Davy had driven for him either the year before or that year in IndyCars. And then the second thing is, do you remember Foyt's post-race or post-qualifying interview?
Oh, yes, where somebody said he qualified and then somebody said, what does your wife think about this? You retire. What's your wife think about this? And he said, I don't know, but my girlfriend likes it, so who cares or something
like
that.
Was that from that? I've heard that quote.
Yeah. No, I heard it over the PA. And, the Foyt at one point, I think he got up to second when pit stop shuffles were going on, and then he ran out of fuel. And the thinking was, and I mean, I've never asked this question, but the thinking was that he wanted to try and stretch it and see if he could lead a lap so that he at least had led the thing. And let me digress and just do a little story that Ron Green, who Kevin knows very well. Mm-hmm. Okay. Ron Green, I think he was still working at USAC at the time, and he'd gone over for one of the tests. And he came back and he said, and he was a big NASCAR fan. And he said, I was over going through the garages and the door opens and the black number three backs out and takes off. And so then...
You're talking one of the tests in 92 or 93?
Something like that.
Before the first Brickyard? Okay.
So off goes the good wrench black number three. And then a few seconds later, here comes Earnhardt walking out of the garage with a headset on. And Ron thinks, wait a minute, who's in the three? And the answer fairly well came to light. It was Foyt. So Earnhardt is standing outside the garage door in the garage area with a headset on, and evidently Foyt must have momentarily lifted going through turn two, and Earnhardt comes on, and according to Ron, he said, hey, fat boy, I thought you told me you didn't have to lift in turn two. Not too many people can get away with that one. Anyway, I just thought of that. And then also,
that's a good story.
By the way, I'm catching up on business here. Marty Robbins had a super modified, which he called the Devil Woman. And then I've also got an early safety story, but I may leave that for later. Okay, hey, Paul, back to you.
I'm doing what I'm calling Project 100. That's I'm going through all my getting my questions ready for May of 16 for you. But one of the things I found in an old climber yearbook was that an article on the 100 mile, the Champion Spark Club, 100 mile an hour club.
Yes.
Can you talk about that, the criteria to join it, and probably the most famous person who, ironically, I don't think, who you talked about last night, who I don't think made it originally on a technicality. You know who I'm talking about?
Peter DiPaolo, because he took a relief driver?
Correct.
Yeah.
Right.
All right. Kevin, what do we got for time here in this segment? Can we do this one?
4 minutes.
All right. Champion 100 Mile an Hour Club is the Champion Spark Plug Company. And this club was founded in 1935. And at that time, I think there was like 8 or 9 drivers who, because they had just got to the point where you could average 100 miles an hour for the 500 miles. In other words, finish in 5 hours or less. But relief drivers were very common in those days. And a driver named Dave Evans in 1933 finished sixth. and he averaged 100 miles an hour. They used to, after the winter crossed the line, they'd let the cars continue running for a while, and so he got sixth. And in discussion with some of the others, he said, you know, this is pretty unusual, quite a feat, isn't it, to average 100 miles an hour for 500 miles without a relief driver. And so champion spark plug got a man named MC DeWitt, I believe is a fellow that said, hey, that's a great idea, PR man, let's form this club. So in 1935, they had the first annual meeting of the champion 100 mile an hour club qualifiers. And I think already some of them were deceased. And it was probably about 12, 13 people. And I remember that Eddie Rickenbacker, a retired driver, was now president of the Speedway. And he said, what a great night this was. And these drivers were like each other's heroes because they were getting each other to sign the program for the evening. And Peter DiPaolo was one of several who were beside themselves because he was the first person to win at an average speed of 101 miles an hour. But he had taken 21 laps of relief from a driver named Norman Batten and therefore was not eligible for the club. And there were some others like Phil Schaefer. And he said, golly, I wouldn't have taken a relief driver if I'd known they were going to do this. And so it became a very prestigious club. And of course, as the speeds went up, in one way, it was easier to make the club, although still relief driving was very common until you get to the after the war, and then that slowed down quite a bit. But anyway, the club carried on until 1970. There's a few other footnotes, but they gave them bomber jackets starting in 1951 with the champion logo on it, and then the champion safety program was formed with drivers going to the high schools, and the early ones were all members of this club. And it went away in 1970. A number of drivers lamented that. In fact, Al Unser won the race and lamented the fact that the club quietly went away. He never got the jacket. And Donnie Allison, the same. He said, I went to the 70 in my rookie year. I went as Foyt's guest. And then he said, after the race, I got fourth. And they said, hey, you know, you'll be a member of the club next year. And he said, I never got my jacket or my patch. And then Johnny Rutherford, I think he said one of his biggest regrets in racing was that by the time he won the race, the club had been disbanded, and he grew up, you know, with all his heroes wearing these jackets. But there's more to it. But anyway, Paul, thanks for calling in. I appreciate your support.
Hey, Donald, can I ask one last question?
Yeah, you have to ask Kevin.
If Donald can answer it in 10 seconds, yes.
Just real quickly, didn't Peter DiPaolo in the Indy 500 record talk about going down the backstretch singing, I've won another $100?
Yes.
And that ties in with what you talked about.
Oh, yeah.
Singing ability.
Yes,
like that. It's a yes or no question.
Gee, I'm lucky. Boy, I'm lucky. This is my lucky day. And he said every time I was, because lap prize money, he said every time I came by the line, I thought, $100, $100, $100.
Thank you, Paul. More questions for Donald coming up on the Talk of Gasoline Alley, FM 107.5, 1070 The Fan. It's the Brickyard Week edition of the Talk of Gasoline Alley. The Crown Royal 400 at the Brickyard is coming up on Sunday afternoon. Activity all weekend long. We'll be out at IMS for the Friday night show here every night this week at 8 o'clock, trackside at 7 o'clock. With Donald Davidson, I'm Kevin Lee. 317-239-1070 is the number to speak with Donald about the history of IMS. Even better, if you can come up with a NASCAR tie-in for us this week, but it's not necessarily required. Don is in Greencastle up next. Hello, Don.
Hi, Don. Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing good. I was just wanting to ask Paul a couple questions.
How about Donald?
Donald, yeah, sir.
Good enough. Go ahead.
All right.
Yeah, how many of the Unser family drove with the 500, and if he knew actually what started that wreck with Sweet Savage?
Good grief. We're going in different directions. How many Unsers drove with the 500? Is six. How many took a rookie test? Seven. Uncle Louis was in 1940, took part of a test and didn't finish. The other six was Uncle Louis's brother's three sons, Bobby, Al and Jerry, not in that order. Jerry was the oldest. Jerry was a twin, or Jerry Jr. was a twin. And the three of them each drove in the 500. And then the second generation drivers were Robbie, Johnny, and Al Jr. And to try and simplify it, Johnny is Jerry's son. Robbie was Bobby's son, and Al Jr. obviously is Al's son. And so what you have is three brothers drove in the 500. They each had one son that drove in the 500. And so the three second generation guys are all first cousin to each other. You got that? And then the other trivia was the six answers. What's the most number of answers to drive against each other in the same 500? And while you're cooking on that one, I'll take a crack at the what caused the Swede Savage accident. Apparently, and this is just from what I hear, and I'm not great on spreading rumors. I've never driven a race car, so I don't know what it's like to be in one or watch somebody else drive one from a rears. But apparently, he was suffering great handling problems. It's been suggested that he had such a severe push that he was coming through turn four with his arms crossed, and whether that's true or not, I don't know. But he had come as highly touted as almost sort of like a Dan Gurney protege. He had an accident at Ontario in the Questra Grand Prix in 1971, which knocked him out of his what should have been his first 500 ride in 71. So he ran in 72. And then 73 was part of the reorganized Patrick Racing team, which had been the Michener team. George McNulty was brought in as chief mechanic. And although Gary Bettenhausen was to be the original one of the drivers, it ended up that he could not get out of a contract with Penske. And so Gordon Johncock, who'd been released by McLaren, came in. A lot of details here, and I'm still not answering your question properly. But Swede Savage was on the team. And with these, with the 72 Eagle, the updated version of the 72 Eagle, there was the chance for Swede to possibly be the pole winner. And I think really that he was driven, if you'll pardon the pun, motorcycle racer, and I mean very much of a superstar of the future, it seemed mm-hmm. like, and very possibly a potential Penske driver, quite honestly. With the good looks and he stood on the gas. So I think that probably he was putting pressure on himself to try and win the pole, and he didn't miss it by much. I mean, he broke the one and four lap track records, but then ended up on the inside of the second row, and he led some laps, but effectively he was running a strong fourth for much of the race, but apparently trying to overcome these handling problems at some point. And he had just made a pit stop, and they still had the 75 gallons on board at that time. So I'm probably speaking out of turn because I don't know that he had just made a pit stop. But anyway, he lost control coming off the fourth turn, and it was just a miserable day. It had been a miserable several days. It was dark and overcast. And I did not see the thing start, but I did see the result of him hitting the inside wall and just this massive fire, which was so bright that it was beyond orange yellow in the middle. And just a terrible accident, and the car just was smashed to smithereens. That was the brand new at that time. Was they no longer had frames. The engine, I think was the term, was a stressed frame member or something like that, that actually the engine was part of the frame. And mm-hmm. I remember not being technically minded, but horrified when I saw one of those up close for the first time. I thought, that thing looks like it could split in half and, fall down in the middle. And so anyway, it happened several times that there were accidents, and the cockpit with the driver would go in one direction, and the driver with the engine with the rear wheels would go in another. But anyway, he did survive for 33 days. He was on a support system, and then he passed away on the weekend of the Pocono 500. But anyway, what caused the accident? Apparently, it from what I hear, and don't take me to court on the thing, apparently it was him trying to compensate for an ill-handling car because he thought this is an opportunity for me to win, and the bit was between the teeth. I was off on another tangent, and I can't even remember what the heck I was talking about, but I finished that to come back to do Sweet Savage, and I was going to...
Well, we started talking about the answers.
Oh, about the answers. Oh, yes. Okay, thank you. I'm glad you're here tonight, as all night. All right, so the question is, there were six answers who drove in the Indianapolis 500 at least once. What are the most number of answers to drive against each other in the same 500?
I'm going to say four.
You're way high. Two.
Really?
Never any more than two. And in the nutshell, it was Al and Bobby. Bobby's career is done by the time Little Al comes along. And then you've got Al and Little Al.
And Johnny raced when Al Jr. was over. And
correct. Right.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
And so Johnny and Robbie ran against each other. And Johnny and Al Jr. ran against each other. There was one year when all three were there and Robbie didn't make it. And so it's just amazing. And then a real surprise, I really thought that Al the third, I mean, the mini Al or whatever.
We all thought he was going to be something.
And, he went by Al Unser and he was running Indy Lights. And I thought, God, they're going to think that, Al's come out of retirement to run Indy Lights. And I said, call him Al Unser the third, because if you don't, the press are going to. And anyway, I just thought he was headed for a 500 start, and it never happened. So
best
anyway.
I know that it was, as with all drivers, it was funding.
Yeah.
But we just thought someone would get behind the grandson of a four-time winner, the son of a two-time winner.
I don't remember what year I was thinking, but it was sort of like 06 or 07 or 08, around in there, I thought. Al Unser the third is going to drive at least one Indianapolis 500. Yeah. I'm really surprised that didn't happen.
Okay, thanks for the call tonight, Don. Thank you. More for Donald coming up. 317-239-1070, the talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan. Open phone line, 317-239-1070. Questions about the history of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway with Donald Davidson. And Yancey in Charlottesville, Virginia is next.
Hi, Yancey.
Hi, Donald. I got a question for you about drivers that, I remember drivers like Frank Lockhart back in the 20s.
Yeah.
That drove in Indianapolis, but then would go down places like Daytona Beach and try to set speed records. And I thought maybe if you could talk about some drivers that had connections with those two locations.
Okay, well, the two main ones, however you look at that, I mean, Ralph DePalma claimed a world record at one time. There was a number of records that Americans set at Daytona Beach that were not recognized in Europe because of the fact that the European regulations were that you had to do the flying kilometer and the flying mile in opposite directions, I think within 30 minutes or an hour or whatever it was, and it would be the average of the two runs. And many of the early American runs that claimed a world record, the Europeans didn't recognize because they didn't do the return run. So Tommy Milton and Jimmy Murphy both were unofficial record holders that were 500 winners. De Palma, as I say, he did a V12 Packard in 1919. But once you get into there was sort of like the real battle for the world land speed record when they started thinking, hey, we're going to have to do what the Europeans want us to do. You had Malcolm Campbell, who was Captain Malcolm Campbell before he was Sir Malcolm Campbell with the Bluebird. And then also you had Frank Lockhart and Ray Keach at the same time. And when Ray Keach first went for the world land speed record, I don't think he'd driven in the 500 yet. And now, they're just sort of completely different fields. But back then, you had, everybody doing the same thing. The Lockhart and Keach battle was interesting because it was rather like Art Arfons and Craig Breedlove both going for it at the same time, but also being friends by the fact that they're sort of two guys alone doing this same thing. And so Keach and Lockhart became quite friendly, but they had completely different approaches. And Ray Keach was driving a car owned by J.M. White. It was the White Triplex Special, and it was a monster. It was powered by three V16 Aero Liberty engines. I mean, one would have been a rocket ship, and there were three. So I don't know how many tons that thing weighed, but the thinking was, the more power, the better. Well, Lockhart had the opposite approach, and he thought lighter is better. And he had a car that I don't know what the thing weighed, but I mean, it was a miniature compared with what Keach was running. And it was called the Stutz Black Hawk Special. But there was nothing Stutz about it, except that it was built in the Stutz building, which is still standing today. The city block of 10th and 11th and Senate and Capitol, the Stutz building, that's where the Frank Lockhart Streamliner was built, I think on like the second or third floor, in a secret place that only half a dozen people are allowed to go. Anyway, the engine was basically a V16. It was Miller based, and in fact, the engine exists today. It's in the Sampson Special that's on display at the Hall of Fame Museum from time to time. Anyway, Lockhart went down there in February of 28, and I think he had a fire and drove it into the sea, drove it off the beach and into the sea to put the fire out. So they brought it back here, repaired it, and went back down there. And he was fatally injured. He made a run, and I think it was 151 cubic inches. I think it was 291 and a half. And I don't know. I may be off slightly there. But anyway, on the return run, he blew a tire and crashed to his death. And he'd entered two cars, and they were both sold. And one of them ended up a lady named Maud Yeagle, M.A. Yeagle, the Simplex Fist and Ring Special. And she purchased the car from Lockhart's widow. So there's an early example of when's the first time that a female sold a championship car to another female, a lot earlier than you'd think. And then so Ray Keach came and drove in the Indianapolis 500, and he'd run some dirt tracks. But really, I don't know. I mean, he was known for the land speed record, which I think was 207 miles an hour or something. Anyway, so he went on to win the 500. And, of course, Lockhart had won the 500 in a very short, brilliant career. But others that did it, let's see. I think then you're coming into the era of the specialists like John Cobb. And then later on, Gary Gabelich and Craig Breedlove, and then, Andy Noble Andy Green and Richard Noble. Andy Green, I think, was an RAF pilot, Brit. But anyway, as far as the other Indianapolis people that went for it, Bill Cummings and Wilbur Shaw were both at Daytona breaking records in smaller classes rather than the out-and-out world land speed record. In fact, I wind up with this one. I mean, these things can go on forever. I really appreciate the people calling and listening to me doing these diatribes and just random thoughts. But Wilbur Shaw wore a helmet. He was one of the first drivers to wear a hard helmet on a regular basis. And apparently it was given to him by Henry Seagrave it was a polo helmet. And Seagrave said, I always wear this, and Wilbur Shaw wore it basically to deflect the rocks wore it in the 32, 500, and 33. A lot of other drivers made fun of him, and then others thought, that's not a bad idea. And then in 34, I think 12 leading drivers wore helmets, and then by 35 they were mandatory, which has got nothing to do with the world land speed record except that he was wearing Henry Seagrave's helmet.
Yancy, thanks for the question.
Thank you. It's like May and July. I love it.
Yeah, okay, very nice. Thank you.
Almost here. John in Plainfield is up next with Donald Davidson.
Hi, John.
It's Christmas. It's Christmas in July.
Oh, thank you.
Hi, guys. Kevin, first of all, congratulations on your dominant win in the race for Ryan today.
Thank you, John. I thought about retiring on the podium.
I was at the state fair last year walking around the grounds, and on the east end of the racetrack, I noticed a sign that said in September of 1964, H.A. Foyt and Parnelli Jones competed in an exhibition harness race. Yeah. I had never heard about that before and wondered if you had any more information or fun stories about that.
Sure. It was a publicity stunt, photo op. A guy named Joe Quinn, who was the safety director at Speedway and a very flamboyant character, and he was on the fair board because the fair board apparently couldn't promote a race themselves. They had to have a promoter of title. And so that's how Don Smith and Bruce walk up in later. But anyway, so it was Joe Quinn for many years. And he had all kinds of publicity ideas. And one of them was to get Foyt and Parnelli out there and dress them in silks and put them on the sulkies. And between the two of them, and I don't want to stir anything up, but apparently the agreement between the two of them was that they would dead heat. And that was Parnelli's understanding. And the fellow that he was running against gave it the whip as they were coming down and took a slight lead. And Parnelli apparently was quite put out by that. But Foyt also participated in a motorcycles. The AMA was coming to town, and Joe Leonard was a good Foyt friend by that time. And they thought, let's put him on motorcycles. So Joe had a bike and gave Foyt some tips. And so they were going to dead heat. And then at some point, Foyt decided to mix it up with Leonard, and Leonard thought, are you kidding me? Listen, Sonny, let me show you a thing or two. But anyway, that was the story on the sulky race. And I didn't know that there was a plaque to commemorate that. But I think it was to promote either the Hoosier 100 or the State Fair Century or something like that.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
I want to try to sneak in Mike in Vernon Hills real quick. Mike, thanks for hanging on.
Hi, Mike.
Hi, guys. Donald, can you talk real briefly about the glory days of the USAC stock car circuit and the drivers on the tracks?
Oh, golly, I've got 2 minutes to do it. I'd love to, but golly, I wouldn't even know where to hardly start here, except that USAC had a great stock car circuit. 50, they took over from AAA. 56, 57, 58 were pretty strong. It fell away for a while and then came back really strong in the 1960s. And I'd like to do more on this, but I got a photograph of the in a Milwaukee program, and it's several cars in a turn, and it's Roger Ward, Parnelli Jones, Bobby Marshman, you know, Norm Nelson, Don White, and maybe Len Sutton. I'd have to think about it, but there's several Indianapolis 500 drivers, and it wasn't for appearance fees. I mean, those guys came to race, and whether it was at Milwaukee or on the high banks or on the dirt out at the fairgrounds, they were always great shows. And in fact, wind up with this, and Joe Quinn that we just talked about, he would bring NASCAR guys in to be part of the show. And Ned Jarrett in 1964 was running third with the Bondi Long. See, I know a little about stock cars. The blue number 11 Bondi Long Ford was on his way to winning the NASCAR championship, I think, the next year. And he was running third and broke down late. And anyway, they were great. So maybe we can address this more tomorrow night.
Okay.
They were great days. Jimmy Bryan, I mean, Marshall Teague, Sam Hanks.
And Mike, we're not ignoring your question via Twitter at @M_MD1988, but I'm going to guess Donald would not be interested in answering this. So he asks, with the 100th, 516, and NASCAR's decrease in ratings, seems like a great time for IndyCar to gain fans. Would like your thoughts, Donald. I'm going to guess you'll defer.
I will defer.
That's
Thank
a question
you.
Yeah. for Trackside, if you care to send that to us at some point. Thank you, Donald.
All
Good
right.
to see.
Thank
we'll
you,
see
Kevin.
You tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. More questions about the history of IMS, and we'll talk about IndyCar and NASCAR with the president of the Speedway, Doug Bowles, in studio tomorrow night, and cover some of the things we haven't gotten to on Monday or Tuesday this week, tomorrow night at 7. Thanks to David Deering, our studio producer. We'll have the podcast up in a few minutes at 1070thefan.com. For Donald, I'm Kevin. Thanks for joining us.